Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey friends, welcome to another episode of the Tennis and Bagels podcast. This is the first Grand Slam of the year that we just finished witnessing the champions, Aryna Sabalenka won the women's tournament without dropping a set, and Jannik Sinner won the tournament in a great way by defeating Djokovic in the semifinal and beating Medvedev from two sets to love down to win the men's tournament. But so yeah, we're here today and just like review a little bit of it and share our thoughts on the rest of the season, what we expect from the players and what we want to see. There's just me and Owen here. How are you doing, man?
Doing well, yeah, thanks. I'm always a little sad when this tournament is over. It is my favorite one all year, but I got both my picks wrong in the big podcast we did with Murray Musings. I had Sabalenka and I changed it to go off at the last second, but no regrets and excited to break it down with you.
Yeah, my pick went out pretty early. Rybakina lost in the second round, unfortunately, which probably was the match of the tournament. Unfortunately, she wasn't on top of it, but yeah, I'm not sure exactly what to think about it yet. Maybe I think particularly if we're talking about that match, I definitely would say that it's because Blinkova peaked instead of like Rybakina just kind of dipping and not playing well. But it could be a little bit of both. Hopefully this doesn't impact the rest of the season. She did have a 6-3, 6-love or 6-love, 6-3 win over Sabalenka the week before. So this should be at least like some consolation prize from leaving Australia. But yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts on the tournament in general?
Yeah, so, and I feel like we should tell listeners Vaunch is going to be doing his regular recap with Steve Frank. Yeah. They're going to be probably focusing more on the ATP, so we're going to lead with WTA and try to spend more time on that in general. So we'll start there. I mean, Sabalenka was dominant, right? I think the one point all tournament where she was in some danger was when the first set against Coco Gauff, when Gauff served for it at 6-5, 30-love after being down a break, I think, a couple of times. And, you know, Gauff probably could have done a little better there, but once Sabalenka got out of that, there was no looking back. I don't think anyone looked even very close to being as good as her, to be honest. I mean, I think that match with Gauff was tight, and going into the tournament, I had Gauff winning that one, but and Sabalenka, it's pretty crazy how good she's gotten and how much better she looks than everyone else right now. I don't really understand how you beat her at this point, because it's all pace all the time. The serve is good. And like the touch is good and the movement has been getting better, but it's almost like those things don't matter because it's just she hits so damn hard and she's like not missing anymore. And there's not really a formula to break that right now. Like Gauff at the U.S. Open, Gauff did her thing and still defended really well, but it didn't throw Sabalenka off at all this time. Maybe in patches, but she was able to recover. So, yeah, I think, and I'll get into a case for this later on, but I think she's the best player in the world right now. What did you think of Sabalenka and any other thoughts on the tournament in general before we get more specific?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in tournament in general, like just because you mentioned that you're always a little sad, like me too. The only thing that I'm happy about is really because it's very hard to follow the Australian Open. And I said it like in one of the videos that I made earlier, that just a shout out to Australian tennis fans because it must be really hard to follow tennis all year long. And the Australian Asia Pacific season is kind of really short in the beginning of the year. And then after that, you only got like China later on. But yeah, so that's the one thing that is like a little bit of a relief for me in that regard, but especially because now we're coming probably back to Americas. So yeah, it's going to be nice for us to have some sleep back. Yeah, about Sabalenka, I mean, I think I grossly overestimated her against Goff in particular. I think the US Open match got me thinking that maybe Sabalenka just didn't have the tools to break the defense of Goff. She was just going to try to hit harder and harder every time, and then Goff would just be comfortable retrieving it. But I think that she got close to getting into that position again when she got frustrated enough with Goff's defense that she couldn't serve. I think she was at some point serving for the set at like 5-3 or 5-4. And then, and then Goff got like a double, got to a few games in a row and like served out for a 6-6-5. Couldn't close it out. I think partly because Goff, unfortunately, didn't, at the tail end of like her time in Australia, wasn't playing her best tennis. The Kostyuk match was a total disaster. I don't even know how that happened. I think even the players were just like confused, like, why is this even happening? Like, did they just make the net higher? There's no way I'm missing this much. So it was just a weird match to watch. And I think she almost got the best of Sabalenka in there. Maybe if she had served out like the first set, who knows, maybe it would have been a bit of a different story. Maybe Goff would have been like, okay, now I'm actually at my good level. I can do this again. I think she got broken to love at 6-5. So it was a...
No, she was up 30 love, actually.
30 love again.
And then it kind of fell apart from there. But yeah, she was really close to that first set.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a good thing from Sabalenka. I think that maybe problem solving was good in that match. I think that belief as well. Not getting frustrated with the defense, with the winners not coming, just playing within herself. And I think that one of the things that Sabalenka does really well, and she could do more, but like obviously like her baseline game is so good that she doesn't really need to, is come to the net. I think that she can finish points at the net really well. She has good baggage from doubles. Where she actually was number one in the world eventually at some point. So, yeah, I do think that Sabalenka, when she is calm and when she's thinking in her game, I think she's the best player in the world. You do have to make her struggle. You do have to get her really frustrated so that's when you open up the space. That's when you make her vulnerable. That's when you make her make errors. That's when you make her overdo it, and that's the only way that you can beat her. And I think probably Goff has the best game for it, or maybe Świątek can just play on certain surfaces. I think Świątek can, you know, namely clay. I think Świątek has the time to produce the shot making that she has to defeat Sabalenka. But I guess like as an all court player, I think Sabalenka is the best player in the world right now. It's just by ranking points that she isn't number one, but I don't think that she isn't the best player. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I made some notes here. So I do want to make the case that Sabalenka is the best player in the world. And I mean, it's not like a fan in me. I do like her, but I prefer Świątek. I really like Świątek. And From that angle, Iga is ahead in the rankings by 865 points, which is not nothing, right? Like that's almost a 1,000 level event, so it's not a tiny gap. And then I think the other thing in Iga's favor is that before she lost at the Australian Open, she was on a 17 match winning streak. So I think you could say, oh, you know, she just lost once, and now everyone's trying to like change the narrative. You should just go by the rankings, but here's where I want to push back. If you look, so Iga is just vulnerable in a way that Sabalenka is not, right? If we look at their results at the last three majors, Świątek has lost in the quarterfinals of Wimbledon, fourth round of the US Open, third round at the Australian Open, and Sabalenka made the semis at Wimbledon, the final at the US Open, and then won this tournament. And going back, their last six results, Świątek won the US Open in 2022, lost in the fourth round of the Australian, won the French Open, and then that takes us to the last three. And Sabalenka, semifinals of the 2022 US Open, won the Australian Open last year, and then lost in the semis of Roland Garros last year. But here's the thing. Sabalenka could have won every single one of those matches that she lost. She was leading in all of them. And that's not to make excuses for her. She lost those matches, right? But the point I want to make is she is going deep at every single major. You can't take her out early anymore. And even when she loses, it's kind of on her. She was in the lead in all these matches. She's up a set or she's up a set in a break. And when she loses, it's sort of because of her head. And whereas you look at Swiatek, and her recent losses kind of hint at matchup problems, right? Like we said for a while, like, why is Ostapenko a problem for her? Because Ostapenko can rush her and take away her time. There's a blueprint. I think the blueprint against Sabalenka is, like, get balls back and hope she, like, self-destructs. And that's, to me, that's not the same thing. I think against Swiatek, the match is much more on your racket. If we look at how she did this tournament, and I want to be fair because I don't think she had her best stuff, but she was kind of marked up in every round. Like, even Kenin did some damage. Collins probably should have won, and then Noshkova did win. I think Swiatek should have won that match because she was ahead, but she didn't. And I think there are vulnerabilities there. You can really rush her, especially on a hard court and a grass court. And I think that group of players that can trouble her is growing. Like, Noshkova is 19 years old. This was the biggest match of her career, and she won. And I think that seems reproducible, right? Because other players have been doing it. I think Rybakina has been real trouble for Swiatek. And now it's not just the top players anymore who are doing it in majors. And so I think if you want to make the case that Swiatek deserves the number one, yeah, she has it in the rankings, but I think you sort of have to say it's all about consistency at tour level, because Sabalenka is doing better in the majors. She's been more consistent in recent majors. And I think she doesn't have these matchup issues. Like, her biggest weakness is her mentality. So I don't know. I think when you compare all of that, it's pretty clear to me that, I mean, you know, Swiatek is still the best on clay, still favorite at Roland Garros. But if you ask me who I would rather play right now, I want to stay the hell away from Sabalenka. And I think that probably most players on tour would agree with that. Sorry, that was a little long-winded, but I hope that made sense.
Yeah, for sure. I think that comes down to, I think an old interview that I think Bonsch did with Pete Bodo in here, was it you? That he said that power is still king in a way. Like, I mean, it, in a sense, like, obviously, we think of all the little things that players can do. We think even of a Medvedev kind of player who can just kind of massage the ball back and just kind of find ways to win in that way. But there's no doubt that if you can just, like, hit winners like Sabalenka, just hit at the pace that she can. Even, like, if we get back to the ATP Tour and, like, looking at the way Sinner has been hitting the ball, there's no doubt that there's a huge advantage if you can hit like that, and if you can hit consistently from both sides, and if you can have hit a big serve, big first serve, and then just kind of, like, defend well in your second serve, you're on a massive advantage to win the big cluster of, like, 0 to 1 to 4 rally shots that you can, you know. So yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think that Swiatek, for the love of that she has to Rafael Nadal, I think she has some of the same weaknesses in that regard, that you can get rushed in that regard. Long-winded forehand that can, you know, cause you trouble if you don't have time. That's some of what Collins was doing to her. I remember, like, seeing so many returns that were just, like, on her feet, and it just, like, she, the forehand, the shape that he has, like, she was just kind of, like, putting it back on court. And sometimes it would work. I think Swiatek is obviously great enough that she can, you know, make it work in a few occasions and win those matches. But there is definitely a level of technique and style that Sabalenka has that allows her to be more consistent across surfaces. So, yeah, I mean, I think that basically And I think I said as well, like in the video that I just recorded, like in the event about the women's final, I think that maybe this win that she had against Zhang in particular, and of course, like the overall, like Australian Open run that she's had, I think that this may help her with the issues that she was having with closing matches. Because she had like a serious problem, like, and she was 40 love up, and she, I think she had like two unforced errors on the forehand, and then Zhang hit like a drop shot winner, yeah. But she didn't play well, like the points that she hit the unforced errors. She just like, there was no need to hit like she did. And then she kind of like took a step back in a way, like in the proverbial step back, and hit an ace and then on break point, and it went on to win the match. So if you're looking back at like the semifinal that she played, in particular against Karolina Mukova, where she was like the 5-1 up and then managed to lose that one, I think that it could, maybe this Sabalenka wouldn't lose that match anymore. So I think that it could be a change that she really needs to, you know, be number one, not just the best player in the world, but like in the actual official rankings. If she can keep that strength, mental strength to, you know, push it over and go over the line and finish the matches. I think that it's a very key point of our game right now.
So I hear you, but I'm kind of going to disagree with that. I thought the same thing for a long time. Like, and I thought it when she won the Australian Open last year. Like, you remember that last game when, against Rybakina, I think she double faulted on at least one championship point. But then I think she had to win it on her fourth one, but then she did. And I was like, I was exactly like saying what you just said. I was like, oh, she figured it out. Like all these demons are gone. She's going to be able to close out. And then she lost against Mukova from a set and a break. And then she lost against Jabeur from a set and a break at Wimbledon. So I kind of think these issues are always going to be there. I think maybe they'll go away a little bit. But I don't know. I kind of think that, and I think we talked about this on Talking Tennis as well when I was when we were talking to John. I think she's just so good that she can now like survive these patches a little more. You know, like I do think she gets nerves. Like that patch against Gauff when she was up 5-3 and then she got broken twice in a row, that shouldn't have happened. She just hit her way out of it because she's so good. Like I don't really think she's like a Zen master or like a mentality master. I think she's just so good at tennis that a lot of the time that's going to overpower the nerves. So like I kind of do expect her to have some more choky losses in the future. I just think there won't be as many of them because her game is so imposing. And even when she is kind of imploding, the points are still played on her terms. Like she never gets tentative, right? I've never seen Sabalenka push. And so if she makes the ball, things are going to go her way. I don't know, you may be right that like now that she has two majors, like getting used to it a little more, playing in more big matches like this, it might happen a little less, but I kind of think that this is just something she has, and it's a weakness she's going to have, but she's so great that it's not really going to matter a lot of the time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, there could be a possibility that is just like a slow learning curve for her, like in that regard, like it, You don't become like a tiebreak master like Djokovic did overnight. Like, I mean, he sort of did that, but like Djokovic is a different story. And we're back in the WTA Tour here. She has two Grand Slams. That's a good number. She's still like building up her career, still her resume. I think that she can still like get even more experience at that level, get even more experience like winning those semifinals at Grand Slams, and it might be just something that she, as you said, like she maybe choke out a few more, but maybe the tendency is going to be that she will do this less and less. So I feel like this could be a learning curve that for her is just a little bit steeper than for others. It's not going to be like a click that I would have mentioned all because she just beat Zhang like in that fashion, and because she was able to overcome Gauff again, like now that she's going to be good for every other match. You may be right. I think that she will still suffer from those things, but she just can rely maybe on the confidence that she has on her own game to just be like, I can hit this ball as hard as nobody else like can on tour. Yeah. So if I choke this game out, I'll just go back to my seat and I'll just like put myself together and just hit it out again and just try to get it over the line this time. But yeah.
And I agree with that. And I want to make a point about Goff as well. Like, as I'm sure she's disappointed. And that match with Kostyuk, that I want to talk a little bit about that because it was so interesting. So the quality was atrocious, as you rightfully pointed out. But I think the takeaway I had from Goff's tournament was she can have a lot of success even when her forehand completely falls apart. Like that, the reason that match with Kostyuk was such a grind was because Kostyuk realized and had the patience to do this. I'm just going to hit every single shot to Coco's forehand because she can't hurt me. She's going to miss. And if she kind of pushes it to the middle, I'll head it back to the forehand until she misses. And so you had these like excruciating rallies where Goff would hit like 10 forehands and like miss the 11th, you know? But the thing is, she won. Even though her forehand was as bad as I have seen, at least in a while. And then against Sabalenka, I don't know that it was like a whole lot better. I think it was still a pretty big weakness. And she lost like a close match in straight sets where she probably should have won the first set. So again, I'm sure she's disappointed, but if you contrast that with when people were saying, oh my God, she has to improve this forehand or she's never going to win a major. I mean, that's completely out the window, right? Like not only has she won a major already, but I think, I don't know, she probably would have beaten Zhang, right? It was Zhang's first major final. Maybe she wouldn't have, but she would have been the favorite. That match against Sabalenka wasn't a blowout, and she just beat Sabalenka at the US Open. I don't think she has that much to worry about, really. Like, I think she's worked out ways to protect that forehand so well that even when it completely fails her, she's still one of the best players in the world. And that was not always the case. So I don't know. I don't know that anyone is saying this, but if anyone were to say, like, oh, Goff's forehand is terrible again, she really needs to work on that, I kind of disagree. Like, I think in an ideal world, it would be a bit better than it was at this Australian Open, but I think she's kind of fine. What are your thoughts on that? Do you maybe see it a little differently? Or
I think that like incremental changes and improvements can always be done in a certain way. Like maybe technique is going to change a little bit over time. Even if you look at like some of the tennis greats, like they have had extremely long careers, you've noticed some things that changed in the way that they hit. So I think that's just something that we cannot just discard it. I feel like it's not something that we're going to, that she would just like have the exact same forehand forever and that's it. I also don't think that she would just be happy with it just because she can defend it well. I don't think that she's just something that's just like, yeah, I'm good, and let's just practice something else. Or I think that there's always a level of improvement that you can do. But I think you're right. I don't think it's going to become like a Del Potro forehand or like a Serena Williams. I think it's going to always be Coco's forehand. Maybe her forehand is her backhand is always going to be her best shot. Maybe she'll always double fault here and there. But I do think that one of the things that she does really well is that she doesn't really let it happen in like all at one at the same time. She doesn't sometimes most a bit for the serving, but it's a whole lot more controlled now in terms of the double faulting. But she doesn't hit like, I don't know, four unforced errors like right away, like to go like a breakdown or to lose a break advantage, because she just kind of had like in a three shot rally, she just hits the forehand long or like hits like really badly. Even sometimes she's able to like hit it aggressively. So I think that she's good. I think that she's trying to improve even as the months go by. I think that she's trying her best to make the shot not be a liability, to be neutral and then to be something that she can actually use to put her in her favor, even if it's not going to be the same level of a Sabalenka forehand in that regard. But yeah, I mean, I think Goff would definitely be in Zhang. I think that she wouldn't have need to do much. I think that she just needed to be pretty consistent. I think Zhang would have been, I think that if we're talking a little bit about the final itself, I think that she was too she was trying too hard, I would say. Like, I feel like she tried so hard to, like, you know, be as aggressive as Sabalenka. I don't think that she, her game plan included, like, maximizing her strength as much as it did, like, trying to match Sabalenka's. Which, as you said, like, I feel like it's, there's no, nobody really on tour that can really do that. So I think that if you were a golfer, I think she would have been just very comfortable just kind of like extending the rallies and having Zhang, you know, and that hitting an enforced error or, you know, waiting for waiting a little bit longer. I think Sabalenka didn't need to wait, but I think golf would have been satisfied with the wait. So yeah, I would say that I agree, like, to an extent that, I think Goff is good enough that she's able to hide the weakness. I don't know exactly who said it, like, but it was, I think it was maybe Dan Shriver, that everybody has weaknesses, but like the good tennis players are going to be able to hide it extremely well. So that's what she's grown to do with her game.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to say that she shouldn't try to make it better. Like, I agree with you that of course she should practice it and all of that, but I guess I feel like the way I would approach it is, like, it doesn't need to be good. Like, she's proven that. It just needs to be good enough.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, this tournament, it was kind of god-awful in stretches, and she still made the semifinals. So I would kind of look at it that way. Like, it doesn't need to be that much better than it was. Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think, and if you go back to the Kostyuk match, I do think that Kostyuk, even though she was patient, I think at some points she just, you know, when you see the target, when you see the price so close, it just kind of stumbled and just made a few enforced errors that made no sense. And a few, I don't remember points exactly like you and Vansh are able to, but I do remember that she made a few, she had a few forehands into the net in important moments. And I just remember just kind of her like shrugging to the box. It's like, what's going on? And I think that Goff, in the level that the match was, I think Goff was just a more mature player, match-wise, to, you know, come out of it. It's like, it's okay, I'm playing god-awful, as you said, but I don't give a crap. I'm just going to win this. Like, it doesn't matter that I'm playing amazing. It just matters that I get over the line and give myself a chance to fight another day. And that's exactly what she did. And I think that, you know, Kostyuk maybe lacked a little bit of that and just try to keep raising her level instead of maybe trying to like a bit of a different approach. It's like, well, if Goff didn't miss on the 11th forehand, maybe she's going to miss on the 12th. I don't need to hit a winner now on this shot, or I don't need to like hit the lines. I'm just playing a little bit more aggressive now to see how it goes and just, you know, see how it goes. But like, I don't think that was much of it. But obviously she displayed like great mental strength to, you know, push that match to a third set and make it as long as he was, because it was a pretty long match in terms of games and I think time as well.
Yeah, like people might laugh at me for saying this, but kind of level aside, I was actually pretty impressed with both players. Like, I think even though I agree with you, like there were points when Kostyuk probably could have attacked a little more, like that her game plan was hit to the forehand and she hit to the forehand. And I think most players aren't patient enough to do that, you know? Like, if they were, every golf match would have looked like that. But they don't. And what does that tell you? Like, in reality, like, why would you ever hit to Goff's backhand when her forehand is there, right? Like, you should go there on every shot. And so when Kostyuk was doing that, I was like, it's a perfect game plan. It's boring. It's hard to watch, but she's doing exactly the right thing. And I honestly don't really blame her for missing on big points. I think she kind of just faded physically in the third set. I think she went down like 5-0 or something. And at that point, you're not coming back. But for a while, I was like, yeah, she's like reduced Coco Gauff, the U.S. Open champion, to like a not quite a moon baller, but like she's just hitting back these like paceless forehands to the middle of the court over and over because she can't do anything else. That was kind of impressive to me, and like in a way that was very like, you know, displeasing to watch. From a tennis standpoint, yeah, I mean, because like that's what Nadal did with Federer, right? Like, you hit to that backhand 11 times or 12 times until it cracks. And kind of a lesser known example, like that's what Djokovic did with Nadal's backhand. Like he would hit to that side like over and over and over until you miss. And it's not just about trying to get the miss. It's about like you make the opponent less confident in that shot, right? Like, you have to hit it over and over, and maybe that shot isn't even that bad, but, like, you don't really want to hit your weaker shot 10 times in the same point, and so that's going to get in your head, and then you're going to start missing more. I actually loved the game plan. That might be a bit of a controversial opinion, but yeah, I had no disagreements that the match was pretty terrible quality, so we don't need to spend more time on it. We can move on.
Yeah, I think just like the last thing that I want to say about is that like when it comes to game plan and not having the patience to execute it, I think that's something that always trying to draw a line like where we can be relatable in that sense. Like if you ever played a match like in a recreational context, in amateur context, club context, there is always a moment when it is like it feels like you see that like huge opening and just like I'm just gonna hit it there, and then like yeah, it was the worst decision that you made in that point because you should have just kept it going because like that was probably the best option. And that's probably what it is. I feel like you mentioned this as well, like when Federer used to play Nadal, that Federer's forehand is better than Djokovic's, like in general. I would say like Djokovic's forehand is amazing, but like Federer's forehand is like an all-time great forehand, right?
Yeah.
And he didn't have the patience to keep hitting to Nadal's backhand, right?
Exactly.
Federer was a kind of player that like saw the open and tried to go for it. Like he wasn't a player of like 11 shot rallies or 25 shot rallies. He was a player of like 3 and 4. Like as soon as he gets a forehand, he's gonna go for it. Anything that's, I think one of the things that you even mentioned that's probably like what caused him to like lose against Nadal. The thing that kind of got him out of trouble was that he just needed a better backhand, and that's why he did at the end of the day. But yeah, I think to execute the strategy, Coco Gauff has what she needs, which is the physical capability of keep it going and not break physically, which as you said, like Austin probably faded in the end, like, just didn't have the energy, and Gauff did. So yeah,
and that the forehand being pretty bad, like of course that puts a ceiling on Gauff. Like she can't, I mean, I feel like with the Sabalenka or maybe a Swiatek, like when they peak, I think it's like, oh my God, like they could just win indefinitely. And Gauff is never going to have that because like she doesn't play as many points on her terms, but she will probably win more majors, right? Like I think for what she has, she's going to be enormously successful by anyone's standards, right? Like
yeah,
she could be, and this word feels like a backhanded compliment, but I don't mean it that way. Like she will probably go down technically as like an incredible overachiever, like doing a lot with kind of a limited toolkit in one sense. And of course, what she lacks in the forehand, she has in her backhand, and she has the speed, best defender on tour, clearly, I think. But I mean, if you say to someone like a tennis expert, if you like pretend they don't know Coco Gauff, I know that makes no sense, a tennis expert who doesn't know Coco Gauff, but like in general, it kind of violates conventional wisdom to say like a player with a bad forehand can win multiple majors, right? Like it doesn't really work in your head, but she's probably going to do that. And I don't know, I think that's really impressive.
Yeah. You think that she can be number one?
Well, so I was looking at the rankings earlier. I think she's 3 right now.
Yeah.
And I think she's still 19 years old. So, I mean, yeah, absolutely. She's right now, she is 2,500 points more or less behind Iga. Yeah, why not? She, you know, if she gets a little better on other surfaces, maybe Iga and Sabalenka have like a down year. Sure, I think it'll happen at some point. Maybe not for very long, but yeah. What do you think?
Same here. I think that she's, as I said, like 19 years old. I think that with incremental changes that I've mentioned and improvements that she can make on her game, I don't see why not. And I think that with her intelligence on court, I think that she's a great problem solver. I think she's going to put herself in just a great position to, you know, exploit whatever weaknesses that she can find over other players and defend hers extremely well so that she can end up like winning more majors, as I said. And I mean, I feel like if she ends up winning more majors and on a more consistent basis, I think that it's really hard not to be number one unless the other player that is number one at that moment is just winning more than you are in other things as well. So,
yeah, I agree. And, you know, kind of zooming out a little bit, I was thinking about how we had that big three on the WTA for a bit, which was Swiatek, Sabalenka, and Rybakina. And now it feels like Goff is on that level as well. And with like Rybakina has maybe fallen out momentarily with that early loss. She's down to fifth now in the rankings. I'm sure that, and it feels a little unfair to like relegate her that way after just like one loss, but it came so early that she lost all of those points. And I'm sure that she will and can and will climb back up soon. If she gets back to her usual level. But how do you kind of see the WTA right now? Like, are Goff, Sabalenka, and Swiatek kind of on their own plane right now? Because it does feel like there is kind of this like group that's distancing themselves from the rest. Like Pegula is fourth in the rankings, but I think it's harsh to put her up there with her record at the majors. Jabeur, I think, can be up there when she's at her best, but since Wimbledon, she hasn't been close, so it feels like she's kind of floating on level two right now. I don't know, it kind of feels like the top three are starting to break away from everyone else. I know Iga didn't have a good Australian Open, but she did win 17 matches in a row before that.
Yeah, I think in terms of consistency, those players are definitely the ones there that I see like maybe in the next 3 to 5 years as being the dominant forces in the WTA. I think that they're going to keep themselves there. And I hardly see much change coming from Jabeur and Pegula in what could be like maybe a defining moment that is going to change them from like top five in the world to a contender for number one, as you know, as we just put Goff in that position. And when it comes to Rybakina, I think specifically that loss, I would say it's one of the things that just happens. I would say like she could have very well just won that match. It's not that she got blown away off the court like by Blinkova. All their players have lost in like earlier rounds and they came back and won bigger tournaments later on. I think that Rybakina is going to overcome that loss. And yeah, it's just the unfortunate nature of the rankings is that you do lose a lot of points. It makes sense, obviously, but like it doesn't necessarily mean that your level has dropped that much in that regard. So it's a bunch of things that we need to see as well. Like, it was hoping that Rybakina can bounce back from it, and like, we'll excited to see like what she does in the next tournaments. Because obviously, like, we had for 2024 not a whole lot that we saw from her. Obviously, like, she had that huge win over Sabalenka, I think, in Brisbane. But that was a 500 to 50? I never remember. I think it was,
I'm not sure, but
yeah, anyhow, it wasn't a Grand Slam. And then she lost in the second round, so it's been now like a week, maybe almost two, that we haven't seen Rybakina play, so it's kind of falling off of our heads, like, in that regard. Like, the problem with recency bias and tennis is just like a week in, week out, like you lose, you're out.
Yeah.
So it's, we have to wait and see a little, but I do think that her level has been consistent enough for that one. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good season of players, like generation of players. Are we going to see a few, maybe if Osaka can get back up there, but like the ones that we have right now, Swiatek, Sabalenka, Goff, I can easily see them. Of course, Swiatek already has four Grand Slams, Sabalenka has already two, but I can see them like going like near the five to eight Grand Slam mark. I feel like if they all could get to some point around there, I think we're going to have ourselves a really interesting generation of players. The next 5 to 10 years of tennis could be really good in the WTA in that regard.
Yeah, I need to think a little more before I guess how many majors they're going to win, but I think I'm really excited for the potential rivalries here. Like, those three players you named are all 25 or under. Now Rybakina is 24. Zhang is 21. Maybe she makes her way up to that group at some point. Vondrousova is 24. And I was thinking, I really like the developing rivalry between Sabalenka and Goff. It's such a pure contrast between offense and defense. I want to see that matchup more. Goff and Swiatek, like, in the past, Swiatek has had her number, but Goff is a little momentum now. She got her first win over Iga towards the end of last year and has lost to her again since. But can that get any more competitive? I want to see Swiatek and Sabalenka play more. And it feels like hopefully we will, because they're all so young and they're all so highly ranked. But I think, and I think this kind of plays into the Rybakina thing, the best of three in the majors, man, it's so tough. Like, before the tournament, how much momentum did Rybakina have? She might have been like the most popular pick for the tournament after she demolished Sabalenka. And then she runs into a red hot Blakova, boom, out in the second round. So it makes it tough, right? Like, these players aren't automatically going to get to each other, because it's really easy to lose in best of three. It doesn't mean they're not consistent. It's just that if you run into the wrong opponent on the wrong day, you can lose. Like, anyone can lose, except Sabalenka right now, who's seemed to, like, kind of become upset-proof. But, like, best of three is just really, really hard. And I think, you know, it's impossible to say what certain best of five matches would have looked like if they were best of three, but we had a lot of highly ranked ATP players who went very deep, who had to play a lot of five-setters, right? Like, they had more margin. Whether you think they would have won in best of three or not, like, they had more room to play with. And these top WTA players or any WTA players just don't have that. And so, I mean, that's why we shouldn't say, like, oh, this player is not consistent, or, like, the WTA isn't consistent. But I don't know. I wish that more of it were best of five, because then I would feel like we would get these matchups a lot more often.
Yeah. Yeah. To be honest, like, I feel like I totally agree with you in that regard. I think that if there's anything that the WTA right now, I think it's consistent. Just because they're not, like, winning back-to-back Grand Slams. Of course, like, Sabalenka kind of just did that, but, like, a year over year, but not necessarily, like, a Roland Garros Wimbledon double. Like, I feel like, especially comparing, like, in comparison is awful, but by all means. But when you start comparing a consistency of, like, a Serena Williams or Venus, even like going back even further, like Clijsters, players like that. For one, it's all in hindsight, right? So, like, their career is already, like, over. Venus technically still playing, but, like, her career is as good as over right now in terms of, like, winning big titles and things like that. So in hindsight, it's obvious that, like, oh, they were consistent. Why couldn't they be? Well, for one, Świątek has already four Grand Slams, so that's, I think, that's pretty consistent to me. One over the course of three years, 2020, 2021, 2022, and 23. So that's one thing. Sabalenka has been extremely consistent in the majors. Just wasn't able to win a few of those matches. And then, like, you got Gauff, who made the final of the French Open and then followed up a year later with the win in the US Open. I think they're pretty consistent, just like, and when I'm saying, like, I think I mentioned, like, the 5 to 8 Grand Slams, I think that for me, that's a mark of a dominant generation in that regard. Like, I feel like that's when we see players who are consistently good in that regard. But I think we could even, like, lower it to, like, some 3 to 4. And then I could easily see Gauff getting to 3. Obviously, Sabalenka could even see, like, getting to maybe 5, depending on, like, how. Well, she got so close, I feel like there's no reason not to say that she wouldn't. But I would say probably maybe, like, she can add, like, another 4 and get to maybe 6. Świątek, I can definitely see getting another 3, maybe 3, 4. But it's all obviously speculation, but I feel like that would be the mark of a consistently dominant generation over the years. So,
yeah. And this wasn't relevant to the who is the best player right now debate that we had at the beginning, but I mean, with Iga, we're already watching a generational talent. Like you said, four majors at 22 years old. And Sabalenka is starting to show us that she might be a generational talent as well. Like, we are watching these, like, we're watching some all-time greats. And I think to sort of harp on, oh, Iga lost in the third round. I mean, I know I did that, but that was only to make the point that Sabalenka is the better player right now. I think that's kind of missing the point that, like I said, these players are probably all-time greats and like already Hall of Fame worthy, and might go down as, like, even more impressive than that. So I think it's a good time for the WTA, mm-hmm. and I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah. And just coming back a little bit to Zhang, and maybe just to mention a little bit of over up that final. I think specifically the final, she obviously beat everybody that she needed to beat in terms of being there. Her draw, like there's talks about like, oh, it wasn't as heavy in terms of like big names and higher ranked players. But I mean,
yeah,
she did what she needed to do. She could have easily choked but because of the pressure of being the semifinal, could have gone either way or quarterfinals. And she got to red hot dominant Sabalenka, and I don't think anybody really
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Expected Zhang to win that match. But what do you think that she did wrong, and what do you think that she could have done better in that match? Maybe to make it a little bit more competitive? Could she have taken a set off of Sabalenka at all?
So I'll preface this by saying that I did not watch either final. Okay. I crapped out with the sleep, and I didn't get up for them. I don't know. I think it's hard when it's your first major final. And I think also when you're playing someone like Sabalenka, who is going to hit the ball so hard, it's like you're nervous already, and then it's like you have no time to do anything. I think that's extremely difficult. So I'm not going to criticize her for this performance at all. I mean, but looking at the stats, I think there are some things to work with here. She won 80% of the points on her first serve. She won 58% of the points on Sabalenka's second serve. So she was having some success offensively and defensively. She didn't break, but she did have break points. She only won 5 fewer points on the return for the whole match. It's not terrible. 6 double faults, that's a few too many. 51% of first serves. Sabalenka had 67%. So ideally, Zhang would make a few more. But I don't know. I think the first major final is more about the experience than anything else. Like, especially when you're playing a better player who you're not supposed to beat. It's not... I don't really see it as like a failure if you lose, because no one was expecting you to win, except maybe you. And I know that the mindset of a professional athlete is difficult. So I'm not... I definitely wouldn't like fault her for thinking like, I failed, I should have won that. But kind of from my perspective, like, I don't really think there's much to criticize. Like, she didn't get double bagels. It's not, she didn't embarrass herself. Like, she competed. She made Sabalenka work really hard in that last game. And now she knows she can make a final. So, she's 7th in the world now. I think it was a great tournament for her.
Yeah, I think that in terms of like the experience, I think she was extremely disappointed not to have won, which I think speaks to the mentality that you must have. Like, I think the worst thing that you can do as a professional player, regardless of like your level, is just like walking on court defeated, especially if you're in the Grand Slam final. I feel like unless you got there like extremely by chance, everybody withdrew, and like you got like some very, very weird conditions for you to be up there. I think that was not the case for Zhang. Yeah, she got like some lower ranked players here and there, some upsets. A lot of the upsets come in the top of the draw, but she still had to play really well. Yes, Tremska was a qualifier, but she's a 3-time WTA titleist on tour, more titles even than Zhang. She's former world number 21. So it was definitely a match that like the ranking didn't necessarily matter in that regard. So she played who she had to. She got there. I do think that in particular, I think that Zhang, yeah, the thing with the stats, I think that it's hard to tell when the things happen. But like the thing for me is like the double faults, they all basically happen in clusters. And okay. They basically, she just gave away a few games because of that. So maybe nerves. I think she tried a little, much to go for the lines. I think that she wasn't necessarily like problem solving with the experience that would come from being in this position before. Whereas I think Sabalenka was just had the advantage of like being a heck of a lot more experience and that level. So yeah, I think now that she's been there, I think that she's gonna be able to look back and see like, okay, we got something to work on now. Like there's a final like right in front of me. There's a player that was the world number one last year, is now the world number two, 2-time Grand Slam champion. I played against her. What can I do better? What can I do to beat her? And I don't have the same weapons that she does, but neither did Goff when she won the U.S. Open. So like,
right.
What level of comparison can I do here? Like, what can I work with? Like, bring some elements into my game. I think that Zhang has great talent, great mentality, and it's just great to watch her play. I think she moves extremely well and defends extremely well as well. So yeah, I'm expecting good things from her. Maybe not great yet, but she got close to great, so who knows, maybe great is on the radar for this season still.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone before the tournament was expecting her to make the final, so I'm excited to see what's next for her. Do you have any more thoughts on the WTA before we head on the ACP a bit?
Not really, just I think we talked a little bit about it, but like or maybe not, because like Vitolina was just kind of had to retire from their match, so it was a bit of a shame. But yeah, I wish she could have gone a little bit further and like played more matches. I think it would have been interesting, a great story as well. So I was expecting good things. Maybe she can win her first Grand Slam this season. I think that's not necessarily off the table. She's definitely like on the dark horse. Dark horse team, but I think that's the one thing that I find that could be interesting to see, and what a shame. But I think that you mentioned and I mentioned, and like the if you can play like Sabalenka, it's really good to have power. So I'm gonna use this very bad segue to talk about Jannik Sinner, who has the power.
Not terrible.
Yeah, who has the game, who has the confidence. Both wings are phenomenal, and yeah. What did you think about this men's tournament? I know you have some questions, but yeah, we'll get to it.
Yeah. Well, I have to start with an admission, which is I didn't think he was ready for this. I didn't even think he was going to make the semifinals, because I had gotten so used to him losing a five-setter to someone before the semifinals. And I didn't want to read too much into what happened at the end of the year, because we've seen it a lot where like, we saw with Felix in 2022, you go on a great run or at the end of the year, and then you come back at the start of the next one, and that level just isn't there anymore. But with Sinner, it was. I don't know, I think what impressed me the most about this tournament was I'm not convinced he ever even had to play his best. I mean, against Djokovic, we'll talk about this more later, I don't even think he had to get out of first gear. A lot of people were saying like, oh, he was so amazing. Like, he was really good. He never had a dip, but I'm not convinced he had to do anything that I thought was like beyond his capabilities, you know? Like, it wasn't like an Alcaraz in the Wimbledon final kind of thing. It was like, he was just solid, you know? And because his game is so good, for him being solid is like amazing and really, really hard to beat. But you kind of would expect it to take a little more against Djokovic, and it didn't. And then in the final against Medvedev, the last three sets, he only faced one break point, I think there was like a 15-30 in there, maybe like a 30-all. He really wasn't under that much pressure. And I think people probably knew what was going to happen in that match by like the fourth set. Because Medvedev was like fading physically. So I'm super impressed with him. I think, like I said, I don't even think this was like his best necessarily. So I'm excited to see what that is.
Yeah. I agree with you. I don't think he was necessarily pushed in this run or this his first Grand Slam title. If anything, he was pushed mentally in the sense that like he needed to stay, you know, sharp and stay awake and for the moments and just like keep her his level from like dropping. I think he could have easily dropped his level against Djokovic when he lost the third set, but he did extremely well to, you know, just understand for himself that he was playing better than Djokovic, that he couldn't let Djokovic's aura beat him. He needed to have Djokovic raise his level to beat him. And I think that Yannick's base level is just incredible. So I feel like because his floor is so high, and I guess we could see this a little bit against Baez, because Baez had to play out of his mind to win a few points. And Sinner just like basically shooting practice shots, right? So like it was almost sad to see like the difference in level in that match, because like how could this happen to a tennis player? Like how can Sinner be that consistently good? He hits with consistent pace and consistent spin. Like you never really feel like he's going to like miss a shot all that much unless he actually overplays, which kind of happens. And I think he did extremely well not to let Medvedev win the third set in the final. And then when that third set was won, I think he was gone. I think all the next two sets were basically the same. They basically happened the exact same thing. And Sinner was just like on cruise mode, like cruise control. He wasn't pushed. He just needed to stay solid and stay sharp. And I think he did just that. I think his floor is just extremely high. I just really want to see his ceiling now, if there's one really. But so that's one of the things why I think we really need more of a Alcaraz Sinner's match. And I think Djokovic needs to play better next time that they play, to maybe produce a solid Grand Slam match. But obviously extremely deserved. Like there's nothing to take away from a Grand Slam title like this. So
yeah, and I think we should talk about Medvedev too, but since we're kind of already on the subject, I want to know what you think happened with Djokovic, because I've heard some theories or like age is catching up to him, and I don't really agree with any of those. Like the people who are like, oh, he could be father time creeping in, like he looked really good at the end of the match against Fritz. And when people are like, he hasn't been good all tournament, like, well, not really, right? Because he barely lost a game against Manarino. He made Fritz play out of his mind to win a set against him, and then he crushed him down the stretch. He played worse against Sinner. So if you're going by that theory, he basically literally would have had to get old overnight. And with one match of evidence, I don't really buy that. And like we talked about, Sinner didn't really get out of first gear. And so I don't really buy that Sinner like kind of shut down Djokovic's entire game, because we've never seen anyone do that before. And, while Sinner was playing very well, it wasn't like tennis that we had never seen before, right? Like Djokovic didn't produce a single break point. I think they made this point on the tennis podcast, maybe, and Sinner made 58% of his first serves, which is not a crazy number. So I don't know. I'm curious, like, what do you think happened with Djokovic? Because I kind of think there was something going on that we just don't know about. And I don't know what that thing is, but I don't think people have found it yet.
Yeah. Well, I've read some things about, like, maybe the day session kind of screwed him over a little bit. Something about this Australian Open just kind of made people play bad matches at times. I think that Djokovic was like really trying. I think defensively, he was being a bit overplayed by Sinner, but I think it was more of a fact that he wasn't really able to like get balls in play the way that he normally does, like with some depth and just defending, like really finding the angles and finding some you know, the lines here and there. But I saw his forehand just like faltering so much, like in this match. I really wish I could see like a more detailed data about like a forehand and forced errors and backhand and forced errors and forced errors as well, like in that regard, because there are so many times that I saw Djokovic building a point rather nicely And he just netted the forehand like out of nowhere. And he was, even himself was getting frustrated at some points. I was just like, what is happening? Like, is something going on? Like, I don't want to like pull the injury card, like, but it was there something going on? Was just like something that was like just mildly bothering him that like he couldn't make it? Or is it just like really just the day session that wasn't very good? Or was it that just Sinner just came out playing well right off the bat? And Djokovic never really had time to settle because he kind of just got down to set still up so quickly. But I don't know. I feel like it was just, if there was ever a bad day for Djokovic, that was it. Like, he just had like a really, really bad day on court. He just did not play a good match. That's exactly what it is. He won that third set by pure grit.
Right.
Purely just refusing to lose the games they should have lost. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason why he won the third set.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I like what you said about it being like a really, really bad day, because people are like, oh, you know, everyone has a bad day. And I'm like, yeah, but this was not a bad day. This was like his worst day ever for like 18 years or something.
Yeah.
Like, the only match in his professional career at a major where he didn't produce a break point, right? And like, it was kind of more than that as well. It was like his demeanor. Like, he, you know, when he would celebrate, he did like the raised fist thing. I don't think he ever like said anything. He didn't make any noise. He didn't yell. He wasn't talking to his box. When he missed a shot, he was kind of muttering to himself and like making gestures. It was like how I play, you know?
Mm.
It wasn't like him. He didn't like take a bathroom break after he lost the second set. And what all of that kind of tells me is that he knew he was going to lose, you know? Like, it didn't really seem like he thought he was going to win. And so I'm curious, like, why? I don't know. It, like, did he... I just don't know what happened, you know? I don't think it was the age thing, because there were literally no signs of that, like, going back 2 days before this match. Don't think Sinner, like, completely neutralized him. I think that was part of it, but he... Like, why didn't he, you remember at the start of the third set, he kind of just became a wall for a little bit, and was just, like, getting stuff back. Why didn't he do that in the second set? Why did he wait to go down two sets before making an adjustment? I don't know, it's just a bunch of things, and I just think there is something going on that we don't know about, because I really, really struggle to explain what happened.
Yeah, it was just a very weird match from Djokovic, where he just... For anything, like, it's almost like we were actually seeing like 2006 Djokovic playing against Federer in his peak, where it's just like, oh, he's just a kid, like, he's obviously going to lose to the guy who's actually better and like more consistent right now. But that's not the case. Like, this is 2024 and Djokovic is the best player in the world. Had just won, like, he was in the final of every single Grand Slam, like, almost, well, I guess almost like too big a word, but like he could have won Wimbledon and could have gone for the calendar year last year again, if it wasn't for Alcaraz, really. And then he comes to the Australian Open and just loses that way. Like, I mean, how much of... I don't buy the age thing either. Like, I feel like he would have been like too rapid a decline for this to happen that way. But yeah, it's just, I don't know, maybe it would, just the lack of energy... Something happened. Maybe he was just like, maybe he just didn't have a good practice time. Maybe he fought against somebody. I don't know. It was just the weirdest Djokovic I've seen in the past couple of years.
Yeah, for me too. And so I haven't watched his full press conference, but I did see this quote from him that was like, I think it was sort of like, yeah, it was like, I don't know, like, it was one of my worst performances, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the beginning of the end or something. So I could be reading too much into this, but like when I saw like doesn't necessarily mean, I was like, that's not like as emphatic of an answer as I would usually expect from him. You know, like I think recently it's like, you know, he's been very clear, like, I'm coming for these records. Like, remember at Wimbledon, he's like, they want to get a scalp, but it ain't happening. Like, he doesn't really, like, mince his words when he's talking about his own level of tennis. And so when I saw, like, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the beginning of the end, I was like, It feels like he has some doubt himself for the first time. Of course, it could just be like he picked the wrong word, you know, and like he's, I don't know, he's just lost in an Australian Open semifinal for the first time ever. But I don't know, I saw that answer and I was like, this does feel like a match that could kind of maybe make him start to think for the first time. I don't know, do you feel that at all? Like, or do you think he's going to go out and win the French Open?
I don't know. I think I keep saying like this to a few people already, but like we haven't even entered the clay season yet. So like, I have no idea who's going to do that. But if maybe Djokovic has some reckoning to do like with himself, I think he should be looking more at the Fritz match rather than the Sinner. I think that if he has anything to work with, it's just like forget about Sinner right now and just like look at the good stuff that he did, which, as you said, it was just like a 2 day before. He played a great match 2 days before he played a really terrible match. Like it's, right. And then his last terrible match was goodness know how long ago. So like, yeah, I feel like if he's starting to doubt, there is something that we don't know. So there is like maybe an injury that he cannot really get rid of. Maybe something that is not really sitting right with him. Maybe he's feeling his energy level actually going lower and he can't really recover after two matches like this. Who knows? Maybe that is something that we are going to be able to see more of this season. But if you have anything to go by from last season, is that I think that he still has maybe another two Grand Slams in him, I feel like. So yeah. I don't think we should be writing him off like quickly just by this one match. I think that we will wait and see like when he comes back to Indian Wells in Miami, which he should be able to play this year. So
yeah, right. Just one more thought on this, like to put on my tinfoil hat for a second and just make some projections. Like that is the most interesting thing to me when we talk about an injury. It's like, but he was fine in the Fritz match, right? Or at least like, if not feeling fine, playing well. And so I'm like, I feel like the two options then are like, it was something that he made way worse in the Fritz match, or he picked up something in the 2 days between the quarterfinal and the semifinal, and either way kind of went on court knowing that he had no chance. Like, because it was so weird, like he just fell behind immediately. He played a good first point and then he fell behind immediately. And there was no sense of urgency whatsoever. I don't know, he was fighting in the sense that like he was, I don't know if he was fighting, you know, like it just seemed like he was sort of going through the motions for a lot of it. He could have broken a racket. He could have taken a bathroom break. He could have screamed at himself. These are all things that he has done before. He didn't do any of that. So, yeah, I don't know. I think the thing I feel most confident saying is that there was something going on that we don't know and that he hasn't talked about yet, because I have no idea what happened still.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe we'll see. Maybe he's going to come out like in a press conference after his next tournament or something, which I don't know it should be, but it's probably Dubai. He likes to play there. So we'll see if he wants to go all the way there now. But yeah, and the other player I think that surprised you again, like the two finalists, Daniil Medvedev had a really rough path towards the final, but he overcame. I think he was down to Sestulov twice in this tournament, Zverev and Rusevori. Rusevori, I had no doubt that he was going to win that match, even when he was to Sestulov down. But Zverev, I don't know, something tells me that he should have lost, but he refused to, which is great. But the Sinner match, and just overall, he's like he has been trying to like apply some differences in his game. I think that he's aiming for good enough. Like we were mentioning about the golf part, I think if he's going to try and do this, like maybe just mix it up a few things here and there. We had to talk about this on Twitter as well, I believe. So I don't know. Maybe he is. And I think that the biggest takeaway from Medvedev for me is just the fact that he seems to be liking the tennis again. Like the Nadal match was a low point in his career in 2022. And now he lost that match, but he looked, in a way, I think I said it as well, like in the video, that he gave a standard answer. He's like, yeah, no, obviously disappointing to lose, but he's excited about what's coming next. And if you remember what he said after Nadal, it's just like, the kid has stopped dreaming. He was just almost like, it almost felt like he was going to retire, like after this, that match, just because of like pure hatred for the sport. That's for me the best thing about Medvedev right now, is that I can look forward to see him playing and try to get some of his best tennis again. So,
yeah, it did feel like we saw more like peak Medvedev than we've seen in a while. And like, I don't know, even the match he beat Alcaraz, that was kind of like a singular performance. Like here, I think we saw more sustained insanity from him. That I agree that comeback against Zverev should not have happened like that. So he's down, returning 4-5 in the fourth set tiebreak, down 2-1, and he hits a forehand winner to get to 5-all, and then he hits an accidental drop shot return winner off of first serve, and then immediately hits an ace, and that's the set, and then he like rolls through the fifth. That's amazing. And then the final, like, he comes out like hitting the ball bigger than center, and is basically up 6-3, 5-1 before center knows what's going on. That's the Medvedev I like fell in love with as a fan, you know what I mean? So like that guy is still there. The pessimist in me is like, well, he didn't have to play Alcaraz and he didn't have to play Djokovic and he still didn't win. So I do think there is like, I don't, the negative takeaway here, Sinner's just a better player than him. That's mm-hmm. it, right? Like, yeah. He wasn't, he was good enough to, like, that great, great game plan and that great execution got him two sets, but then he got a little tired, and his regular game just wasn't enough to get him another set. I don't know, it's sad. I'm more sad for him than I've been for a player in a while. Like, he spent more than 24 hours on court in 2 weeks. He set an open era record. And it wasn't just like those five setters, like Nuno Borges. He's up two sets, should have won the third, throws it away. Basically, he does the thing where he's like serving super fast, and just losing point after point after point. And so he loses that one, has to play a fourth set. Nothing came easy for him this tournament. And I imagine there must have been a moment in that final when he was up two sets, and he was 6 points away from winning 4-all and deuce on center serve in the third set. I feel like there was a moment where he probably let himself think like, oh crap, I'm actually going to win this, aren't I? Like, I did all this work to stop myself from losing, and now I might actually win this tournament. And then, you know, of course, as soon as that happens, it gets ripped away. Sinner played a great final. I've heard some people mention, because again, I didn't watch it, so I guess I don't know if he played a great final, but I saw some people say that he didn't really change anything in the third set. In the fourth and the fifth, he just kept making Medvedev do what he had been doing, and Medvedev couldn't do it. You can set the record straight on that one if you want, but I'm just so sad for Medvedev. Like, it feels almost unfair that he didn't win that tournament.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going off of, like, I've watched the third and fourth set of that match, and then I went back to sleep. But from what the commentators were saying, from what some Twitter people were saying as well, and from a graphic that I saw, a specific graphic about Sinner's return position, Sinner actually made some tactical changes in the third set that helped him make the points longer and not allow Medvedev short balls so that he could attack, so that he could keep Medvedev in the neutral rally in his own service game. I think Medvedev definitely looked a whole lot tired, more tired than he was. I think that it's partially because of the many hours that he spent on court, and maybe the super aggressive tennis that he was playing kind of pushed him a little bit too far, and he couldn't sustain it. Maybe because of the fact that he was so tired already because of the tournament. Maybe if he had a bit of a more calm path towards the final, like a less, something with like less crazy matches and less crazy comebacks. I think he could have maybe won the third set. Maybe he could have toughened it out, but he just didn't have the energy to it. He just looked like he couldn't make it. He was trying to go to the net, and he was working, actually. He was playing some really great volleys, but he started making errors of the forehand. Like, I think both the third and fourth set, he actually hit a forehand and forced error to end the, to get broken and give the set away. And Sinner actually took a step, like some big steps back from the return of serve. I think that the commentators are saying at some point that he was actually trying to like be really close to the baseline so that he could cut off the Medvedev a wide serve. But then it wasn't working anyways. So what I ended up doing is he was actually like right by the baseline for sets one and two to return all serves. And then he went back to the Melbourne sign in the third set. And then the match got long. And then he didn't necessarily have to change anything in the terms, in the sense of like the neutral rallies. Like he wasn't forced to play amazing shots here and there. He played amazing shots here and there because it's Sinner and he likes to be flashy. But he wasn't forced to go above and beyond. He just made some technical changes that made Zverev work harder, and that was it for it. And of course, like winning the third set, I think was a major relief for Sinner. He was basically a different player. He just never really felt it. From his own body language, Sinner was passing that he never felt that he was going to lose that match after the third set. He was just like, okay, I know what I'm doing, and it doesn't look like Medvedev is going to change. And his level never dropped. He felt like a machine, just kind of like going with the flow, and playing well. So yeah, I mean, props for Medvedev to actually kind of making the competitive after the third set, but he was all Sinner from then on. So yeah, but I think that maybe we have seen the ceiling for Medvedev, but at least is high enough that we can get like some really good competitive matches. So we'll see what happens next.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe there'll be a tournament when he doesn't have to play Djokovic, Alcaraz or Sinner, and then he should win that one. But, and yeah, I do want to distinguish this final between from the one Medvedev lost to Nadal. Because this one, it seems like he didn't really have chances to win. The Nadal won all three of the sets he lost. He had chances, especially the third. And this one, it really seems like after the second set that he won, he was just pretty solidly outplayed, where the Nadal one, I think, was more of a choke. And then one more thing on Sinner, I do want to say, like, and I think this speaks to maybe he hasn't found his ceiling yet. After he won, I saw a lot of people saying like, oh, like, Darren Cahill's done such a great job with him, and, he's reached the pinnacle. And I'm like, he's been working with Cahill for a while. Like, this didn't happen at Wimbledon or the US Open. And I don't disagree that Cahill has done a great job with him. But what I mean to say is, like, I think the biggest difference between this tournament and the other tournaments was just that, like, Sinner never played badly at any point, right? Like, the match he lost to Zverev at the US Open, he was a better player than Zverev. He shouldn't have lost that one, but he did. And in this tournament, he did everything he was supposed to. I think that was the biggest takeaway. You know, like, he didn't really change anything. I don't think, like, he served very well, but he did everything really well. And like, he didn't really like revamp his game. So I don't think it was like, I don't think he's like completed his evolution. I think he just kind of, I don't know, like blocked up the leaks in his past performances. I think he can still get better.
Yeah, I mean, as we said before, like, I don't think we've seen Sinner being pushed, so we didn't really get to see him having to problem solve against the best players in the world. We've seen this before against Alcaraz, but we've seen this against Djokovic as well, like last year. But just like looking forward for more of these matches if they can play again at Roland Garros or Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, some of the Masters that are coming up. I think that this is going to be interesting to see. But yeah, that's basically my biggest takeaway, I guess, from this one. I think that maybe the biggest difference, like, in terms of like, the Nadal match for Medvedev, I think that one of the biggest things is that maybe Medvedev never expected to win this tournament. So it was just like playing, taking it match by match, just point by point. And I think he served way better against Nadal. And exactly, like Wazzy said, I think he kind of choked. But yeah, he could have served way better versus against Sinner. And I think that's something that he should be looking into with Jill after this one.
And that's a great point that I don't think he expected to win this one. And probably as soon as he did it, let himself expect to win it, in the middle of that final was when he lost. Not saying that's the reason why, but yeah, I think you're totally right. And it is interesting that the psychological effect that has on players. Like, I don't want to waste podcast time talking about him, but Zverev has that. Like, he, when he's expected to win, the guy just falls apart. And everyone is very lucky that that happens because he was 2 points away from making the final. And by, our friends at Open Era talked about this, like, he would have been given a speech. The other finalist would have been saying nice things about him, the tournament. Like, it's really, really good that we avoided that situation. But as long as ATP doesn't do anything, it is a risk. And like, he's been playing well. He just beat Alcaraz again. It's really, really worrying, and I think, I hate to say it, but I think as long as everyone continues to push their luck, like, probably he will be in a final at some point. Who knows, he could win. I don't want to talk much about it, but like, we're really lucky that like Medvedev won that match. Because when Zverev beat Alcaraz, that could have been a major problem.
A major problem. That's just...
Yeah, right. Mustering, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. The point you make is obviously serious, like in that regard. It's just a huge shame. I do like the fact that a lot more media outlets are deciding to speak about it. I think at this point, when the accusations got to like the actual just legal system, I think it was probably green light for everybody to be like, okay, now we can talk about this because it's actually happening. It's public knowledge in that regard, so we can set some speculations here and there. It's definitely awful for the game when he's just answering the questions the way he is. Like, as in, at some point, like somebody said, like, are you going to be attending the trial? And there are ways that you can answer this, regardless, like to defend your PR nature or something like that. I feel like even his team is like, who cares at this point? Like, the ATP isn't doing anything. The guy's still making millions. Everybody's promoting him. There's no need to like protect his public image anymore because everybody else is already doing it for free. So,
freaking Patrick Mouratoglou,
exactly.
What Zverev could do is like not be an asshole about all of this. Like, when people are asking him about it, say like, no comment, there's going to be a trial, instead of like, and everyone with a decent IQ knows that this isn't the thing or something. Like, dude, like, God. And it's things like this that I think like just make it impossible to defend him on any level. Cause if he were saying like, yeah, I believe really strongly in like, that like domestic violence is awful and I would never do this, and he'd, I don't know, be like a super gentle guy on court, then like he'd probably have more people defending him. But instead you see him like, I don't know, like the racket thing in Acapulco with the umpire and like the way he handles it, it does not point to like an innocent guy, does it? So
I mean, it's just really awful, like in that regard. I think that when he says like, and to the question that he answered this, I just played 4 hours of tennis and this is what you asked. It's like, yeah, this is what I asked, because like tennis is definitely a secondary issue here. Like, I mean, it's just saying like, it's like, there's a ways that you can even answer this. Like, I feel like, as this is what I said, like, I feel like nobody cares anymore. Like, not even him, because he could just easily say like, hey, look, I'm right now, I'm really frustrated. I just lost a really important match for me. Like, I would rather not comment on this matter or something like, I'll happily take just the next question. I just be at least like polite. You can do so many different things. I'm just kind of playing like devil's advocate in a sense here, just be saying like, oh no, it's like maybe he got acquitted in his trial. I don't think that's going to happen because they already decided that he was guilty at the first time. So that's already something that we should take into account. But I mean, just at the very least, like, be polite. But I think he's just being given all the platform to just continue to be disrespectful towards everybody. And
right.
Just when everybody promotes him like that, everybody just talks to him, talks about him like for some reason, the next big thing, like a big guy, like Netflix gives him an entire episode. I think that it just gives him a platform to say, like, hey, everybody loves me. So, like, I don't care. Like, everybody can come at me. Like, I can do anything to anybody. And as you said, the things that we can see from the outside and from even the initial thing that he has to do, like the fine that he has to pay, which he was considered guilty for, does point towards not innocent. And there is also seems to be a history. That's not the first time that this happens, and is kind of too close from the two accusations, like the Olga Sharipova thing, and then now like his the mother of his child. So I mean, yeah.
You cut out for a second, Andre. Right when you said Olya.
Yeah, like when she, it's too close. Those two things are too close from each other, for it to be like too much of a coincidence. So, yeah, I don't think it doesn't look good for him, and the fact that he doesn't recognize that makes it even worse for him, honestly.
Yeah, and like if you read like Olya's story, like that Ben Rothenberg reported it on, like it's a very very detailed story, yeah. Like. It's people do not go to that much trouble to smear someone. Like, it would be completely insane. And the fact that, I don't know, so many people are saying, like, oh, she's like, she's making it up or whatever. Like, the fact that that's what people are jumping to is crazy. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like of the people who read that story in good faith, like, no one wants Zverev on court. And so we want him in court, not on court. Little tennis joke there. So I wish that I wish the tournaments would do something. And like even as far as like not unnecessarily like promoting him or putting him on raw labor, like you don't need to put him on your main courts, guys. Like you don't need to market him. So just like, you know, market some other players. It's not very hard. Like he's not, well, like you said, he's not the next big thing. Like you tried to push him as that. He wasn't. He still hasn't won a major. Not that that would make any of this okay, but it's like there's an option available to people where it's like you don't have to view this guy as the main character. Like the Breakpoint thing is just insane to me. Like why would you? There's no way that they didn't know about the allegations. Like if you did any research at all, like you would know that. And they were like, you know what would be a good idea? Let's make this guy the hero and let's like try to make Medvedev the villain, which like, I don't even know why you have to connect the two. It like, I don't know. I think it just shows how like, it's another example of how nonsensical that was, but that was crazy. And, oh God. And yeah, I think we talked about this before, but again, like people are going to watch that episode and like, they'll feel like, oh, he's so great. He came back from an ankle injury. Let me like Google him and see what's going on. Yeah. And they see like, going to court in May for assaulting someone. Like you really want to burn off fans like that, Netflix? Like you had to know that was going to happen too. Like that's what's going to happen when you like create this false picture of someone. So anyway, this is turning into a bit of a rant. It's like he's going to keep going deep in tournaments, man, because he's playing well. So
yeah.
I hope someone does something about it.
Yeah, it's the sad truth is that like it seems like not only they're not doing anything about it, and he doesn't seem not only not bothered by it, but motivated to play better because of this. But yeah, I think there's of all the several ways that people could be handling it, like organizations could be handling it. This is not it. I just do think that they chose like probably the worst path possible to deal with the things that are happening with Zverev. So. Yeah, it's just the unfortunate shadow that lurks around the tennis world right now. But yeah, hopefully we don't have to deal with this like for the whole year. If the trial happens in a way and it just gives us something. So yeah. But yeah, enough of us freaking Zverev. And we can close this one right now. As you said before, Vansh is going to be coming back with Steve Flink later this week to be reviewing mostly the men's, the ATP side of the tour, of the tours rather. And it's going to be another great one. I'm excited to hearing it. And thanks for everybody for listening to this podcast. Thanks for subscribing to YouTube channel if you do so, or sharing videos or sharing our podcast with your friends and family, whoever. Make sure that you can follow us on our social media as well. We are at Tennis and Bagels. Owen is at Tennis Nation. I'm at Roland Berg Andre, and Vansh is at Vansh V2K. Thanks so much. Thanks, Owen. Any final remarks?
I don't think so. Yeah, aside from the Zverev thing, I think it was an amazing tournament. I was at the 2023 Australian Open, so that one always is going to hold a special place in my heart. But the quality of tennis this year, I think, was immeasurably better. I think it's a great way to kick off the season. And I'm excited for the rest of 2024.
Yeah, me too. All right, thanks everyone. And see you guys next time. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.